And good afternoon. Welcome to Tuesday here on the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride, and we have got a very important topic to discuss here in hour number one. Now, as many of you know, it's Military Appreciation Month, and we certainly are nearing Memorial Day. Dr. Chris Ann Gordon, a Marysville physician and expert in traumatic brain injuries, is making it her life's mission to help veterans facing this challenge by sharing not only her medical expertise, but also her personal struggles to overcome her own struggles with a severe brain injury. Dr. Gordon's journey back to a new normal took over a year, and as a result of her experience, she has formed the Resurrecting Lives Foundation to help spread the word about the symptoms of traumatic brain injury so that together we can help save lives. More than 750,000 nationwide struggle with the effects of their military service in the form of traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder. Unfortunately, fewer than 30% of these veterans receive any treatment at all in a VA facility, and fewer than 10% receive the best rehabilitative treatment. That's an interesting statistic. Joining us today to discuss all of this, a very important topic, Dr. Chris Ann Gordon. Dr. Gordon, how are you?
I am doing well, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be speaking with you today. I truly, truly appreciate that.
It's such an important topic. Now, when we talk about traumatic brain injury, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear that word, or series
of
words?
I think that when people hear TBI, the most concussion is what comes to their brain first, you know, somebody who had their bell rung or somebody who was maybe injured in sports, because I think that that's where most people had perhaps their first, you know, kind of encounter with something happening with their brain. What we are learning, though, is that it can be a much more serious than just one particular incident, and that we've learned from the NFL and from our athletes that it can be a cumulative issue. And the same thing is true with our young veterans. And I wanted to mention that in your statistic, the 750,000 young men and women from the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts only represents them. It does not represent how many of our Vietnam veterans, you know, continue to struggle with effects of a traumatic brain injury from mortar shells, from hand grenades, from all of the things that come, you know, with combat or even with military training.
Mm. How did you come in contact with this?
You know, my particular traumatic brain injury was quote-unquote mild, and it was considered mild because I was unconscious for less than 20 minutes. I literally hit my head against a brick wall while I was moving some things around in the house, but I did it with quite a bit of force, enough to knock me out for nearly 20 minutes. What I realized, though, you know, as a physician who was treating people with traumatic brain injury and now as a patient, is that there's nothing really mild about it, you know? I may have had a normal MRI when a friend finally came and kind of found me in the basement and took me to the ER, but I couldn't speak for about 6 weeks, and I had no feeling on the right side of my body, and it did, as you mentioned, take me about a year to make my way out of it. So what I wanted to do is to kind of write this book as a manual of hope for many of our returning veterans who have had much more serious, you know, injuries in combat, in training, you know, in explosions of IEDs or the improvised explosive devices or rocket-propelled grenades, and come back and not quite themselves but don't really know why. And I want them to be able to talk to a physician about it and to get some treatment.
If you don't know that you have it, but you think you might, what are some signs that you have it?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, I will tell you that one of the most hallmark signs for our veterans is kind of a difficulty with processing light. Right now here in central Ohio, it's really bright sunshine, something we haven't seen for a long period of time. But if you've had a traumatic brain injury, you know, the bright light processing is very difficult for you because of visual changes that occur in the brain. And you can imagine what this is like for our young veterans, particularly in a place such as Iraq or Afghanistan, particularly Iraq, where there's such bright sunlight. Headaches are frequent, and they can either be of kind of just the overall headache that we've had, all of us, once or twice in our life, but they come much more frequently, or a migraine type, which is accompanied by some either visual symptoms or nausea and vomiting. You may have a difficulty processing information as fast as you did. I think with our athletes and our veterans alike, I mean, the one thing about this two groups of people is they're the most fit people in our nation, you know, and yet they look great, but they have trouble processing information, processing new information as well as old, as well as memory. So I think we have to keep in mind that if you served and you, you know, volunteered your life for our rights, you have rights yourself, and that is the right to a really good medical evaluation when you return.
If you are having some of these symptoms, terrible headaches, trouble with the light, and you go to your doctor, is your regular practitioner liable to know what's going on?
You know, we are very lucky that athletics have brought a lot of focus on traumatic brain injury. So I will say that a lot of our primary care physicians throughout the nation are pretty skilled at taking a good history for a traumatic brain injury. We also know that all of our veterans in the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts have the ability to go to any VA that may be near them and sign up for a complete physical and hopefully get some further treatment there as well. Interestingly enough, we are very blessed, I think, that just a couple months ago, our president signed the Mission Act, which is kind of increasing the opportunity for our young veterans so that they can go to specialists in their area. That would be like my specialty, physical medicine and rehabilitation, or neurologists who are specialists in the brain, and be able to receive treatment much closer to home, kind of in a setting that they're a little bit more familiar with. They no longer have to go to the nearest VA facility, particularly if it's, you know, 30 or 40 miles away. And I think that is really going to be a gift for these young men and women.
Having gone through one of these injuries yourself, when you were not able to speak, what goes through your mind? What do you think about?
You know, this is really funny because the thing that went through my mind is, why can't I do this? And then it dawned on me, like, before this incident, I could have mapped out the area of my brain that is affected right now, you know? And yet I couldn't figure out why I was unable to speak, and I was very nervous and anxious, as all of our young heroes get when they have something, that you're not going to get it back. You know, what if this doesn't come back? I mean, I'm sure that they feel that same way about some of their vision, some of their superior balance that they may have had before the injury, and now they do not have that superior balance. So I think it is, what is happening to me? What I've got to say, and this is why I'm so thankful to be here, is to let all of our young athletes, our young veterans in particular, know that they are out of their brains, not out of their minds. Because when your brain isn't functioning, you begin to think, oh my God, I must be crazy. Like, I have a normal MRI. Why can't I speak? You know? So I think that that's what you really have to hold on to, is yes, there can be something that isn't found by normal testing, but can still be treated, and you really need to treat it by rebooting the brain. I mean, I worked on trying to be able to speak on my little Apple computer because I was off work, I couldn't see patients, for several hours a day in kind of 15 to 20 minute chunks, you know, because your brain's pretty fatigued when you have a TBI as well, in order to listen to somebody speaking and try to read the words and try to formulate my words and do that. So what I tell all of our young patients is, okay, you've had an incident, you've had an injury, it's going to take a lot for you to bring it back, but it can be brought back. And I think the most important thing is, unlike a muscle strain or even a fracture that gets better in stages, the brain does not get better in stages. Like, I could not speak until the moment I could speak in a complete sentence, okay? It's, the brain acts like electrical wiring. It doesn't act like anything else in the body. And until a complete circuit is laid down and the switch is given, you are unable to do that activity. So please don't give up. If you're trying to do something, you know, that's why the rehab becomes continual, hard, but very rewarding.
Are all people with traumatic brain injuries treatable? Can they all get better?
You know, when we talk about what we're talking about, which is mild traumatic brain injury, the answer is that yes, most, in fact, 90-some percent get better within about the first 60 days. So that is a very helpful and a good statistic. It doesn't mean that you may not have a couple lapses in memory or some balance issues, which is why I believe that everybody with a mild TBI deserves treatment and treatment options. If you have one of the more moderate or even a severe traumatic brain injury, I still believe, and I've seen patients get better, it usually takes a much longer period of time, and depending on the degree of the severity, it's not like something that you can always function, you know, quote-unquote normally. You know, I think you have to keep that caveat. The most important issue that we see is this is the decade of the brain. The medical profession is now really going in, getting new neurodiagnostics, new radiologic techniques to look into the brain, and then new techniques to treat it as well. So I say to everybody, please keep hope. You know, I really do believe that a lot of it takes being able to get to the right resources and being able to hang on to hope with a good support system, primarily through your friends and family.
Why do so few people get help?
You know, I think because you think you can shake it off. You know, the mild TBI is often something that somebody's not even knocked out about. They're not knocked out like I was. You know, they may have been just a little dazed, or, you know, a gun went off, a major artillery went off, and they were a little dazed, but they just shake it off, particularly our veterans and our first responders. They're all very much service-connected people. So even though they may get an injury in the line of duty, they don't necessarily dwell on it. You know, they are service personnel for a reason. Their first and foremost mission in life is to provide service for somebody else. So I think a lot of it is that they kind of put their own needs or their own thoughts about this behind themselves and just think that it's going to work its way out. And again, if you think of the brain as a computer, you know, you can keep hitting the start on your computer, but if the hard drive is down, you've got to reboot it before you're going to get back to what we call the new normal, which is, you know, a brain that is rewired but may not be wired exactly the same as the brain before you were injured.
If you are somebody out there listening right now or know somebody who you think has this problem, what would you tell them to do?
You know, the first thing I've got to tell them is please talk about it. Please let your family, your support group know. Please get to a physician and give them the entire history of what happened to you, what you've been noticing, and don't stop at just one visit. You know, we have a lot of our young veterans who will go into the VA for their physical and then do not go back for one reason or another. It is something that you need to keep exploring, keep having hope, talk to other people, get on the internet and look at some of the really, really good stories, statistics, information about traumatic brain injury, because it is something, like I said, it's part of rehab. You have to work your way out, but please do not be afraid to do it, because the sooner you rewire your brain, the better off you're going to be in the long run.
Mm. Before I let you go, the new normal, why do you call it the new normal?
Yes. I will tell you, that is a phrase that was coined by Brigadier General Lori Sutton, who was the Army General Psychiatrist in charge of all of the traumatic brain injury when it first started in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I will tell you, she is a brilliant woman, one of my mentors, who said, wait a minute, these young men and women are coming back and there's something going on with them. We're going to explore and see what it is. And what she noted as she put together the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center in Washington, D.C., is that when your brain has been damaged, it sometimes, when it rewires, it moves around existing circuits, and you may not be the exact same personality, the exact same person that you were before. I will tell you, me before my injury would have never agreed to this radio interview, because I really did not talk in front of groups sort of people. You know, I was somebody who tended to want to be a lot more introverted than I am now. I also was great with numbers. I mean, I could add up my grocery bill before the cash register could. You know what I mean? Before the computer did it, I was there. Now, I have trouble balancing a checkbook, you know, but I'm talking to you, and I'm writing a book, and I'm doing things with my right brain that I didn't even know existed before the injury. So what I learned to do is to embrace the new parts of my brain that were working, because if you actually exercise the part of your brain that's working, it will drag the part of your brain that isn't working right out of where it is. And that is why I say it's a new normal. It's not quite the same, but it can still be a really good brain to work with.
Dr. Chris Ann Gordon, a Marysville physician and expert in traumatic brain injuries, has suffered one herself. Dr. Gordon, thank you so much for giving us the time.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and I look forward to future communications.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
How about that? A very interesting topic when it comes to this time of year, Memorial Day, and May being Military Appreciation Month. Certainly, we want to appreciate our veterans and remember them, and a lot of people suffering with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD. That's amazing. More than 750,000 people nationwide struggle with the effects of their military service in the form of traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder, and fewer than 30% of these veterans receive any treatment at a VA facility, and fewer than 10% receive the best rehabilitative treatment. So, if you know somebody who has it, or you have it, you might want to get that checked out. Now, we do have some trivia questions here for the next 27 minutes today that we did not get answered last week, and we do have some prizes to give away. We have a Jags t-shirt, we have a CRT insulated coffee mug, we have a Jags insulated coffee mug. So we do have some stuff here. And we're going to have a guest here momentarily. By the way, today at 2 p.m., 2:15 p.m., the Adam the Computer Guy show will be live in studio. So Adam will be here live to take your phone calls. You won't want to miss that. Now, here are the questions we did not get answered last week. Taco Bell tried to open in Mexico. They tried on two separate occasions to open in Mexico with a different name. They did not call themselves Taco Bell. Now, can anybody tell me what name Taco Bell tried to open with in Mexico on their two failed attempts to open Taco Bells in Mexico? Does anybody know what name they use? That's question number one. Now, the other question we did not get answered was, how did Chipotle start? The restaurant Chipotle, how did they start? These were the two questions from Friday that we did not get answered when it came to food. Also, if you want to call in and just answer the question, feel free to do that as well. 740-383-9944. When Taco Bell tried to open up restaurants in Mexico, what name did they use, and how did Chipotle start? Those are the questions. Now, we also had some questions when it came to WWGH trivia. Where did we broadcast from in March of 2018? Where did this station broadcast from? Now, we know we broadcast from Pittsburgh, but we broadcast from a historic location in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in March of 2018. What was that historic location? Also, we have this question. Who were the first three panelists on the game show Clue Me In? Now, Clue Me In was a game show that debuted here in March. We did three episodes, and we have two of the panelists already named, Mary Ellen Withrow and Buckeye Guy. Who was the third panelist for the first three episodes of Clue Me In? Let's see if we had any other ones. I know we got some of these knocked out last week. Oh, yeah. Bill Macy, who turns 97 years old this month. Legendary actor Bill Macy from movies like The Jerk and TV series Maude. How did he say he was going to spend his 97th birthday? during an interview with me, I think back in March, we had that interview. How did Bill Macy say he was going to spend his 97th birthday? And then the other question we don't have answered, can anybody tell the funniest talk show story in the history of talk shows as told by Shecky Green every time he's on this show? So those are the questions. We've got the Jags t-shirt. We've got the CRT insulated coffee mug. We've got the Jags insulated coffee mug. Those are the prizes today. Or if you just want to call in and get the question right, feel free to do so. 740-383-9944. Tell the funniest talk show story as told by Shecky Green. How did Bill Macy say he was going to spend his 97th birthday? Who were the first three panelists on the game show Clue Me In on this station? Where did we broadcast from live in Pittsburgh in 2018, March of 2018, a historic location for broadcasting? How did Chipotle start? How did the restaurant Chipotle start? Does anybody know that? And the two attempts that Taco Bell made to try to open up a restaurant in Mexico, what title did they use? What was the name of the restaurant the two times they tried to open up in Mexico? What name did Taco Bell use? 740-383-9944. And as I said, Adam the Computer Guy has joined us in studio. And again, his show will be heard live today from 2:10 to 3 p.m. right here on this station. Adam, how you doing? It's sunny, but a little chilly, but that's okay.
Just a touch. Not too bad outside. At least it's not windy like it's been.
Did you go slap on the feed bag before you came here?
Oh, yes, and I also saved big money at Menards.
Oh, good.
I like to stop there also.
Now, are you a handy guy?
I'm handy with telling other people how to fix things and what to fix, but not necessarily fixing myself. I mean, I can unclog toilets.
I understand. Well, can you snake them, or can you just plunger?
Actually, that's one of my specialties is toilet snaking.
Well, that's good. Is it nice outside?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of really sunny days. I kind of like partly cloudy, but it's okay. It's not too hot. It's not windy like it's been. The air quality seems okay. My allergies aren't really giving me too much trouble, so I think it's decent outside.
So what's coming up today on your show at 2 o'clock?
Well, I'm sure we'll discuss more about the money Facebook and other companies is being held liable for with all these antitrust laws, a possible breakup of Facebook, maybe new booster chair models for Mr. Zuckerberg. You may cover the top 50 websites again, new smartphones, and of course, you can call about music trivia or TV trivia or politics. Or again, try to stump me with a question, or maybe there's something going on weird with your computer in your pocket or your home or somewhere else in your life. I'll be happy to address the problem and might be able to fix it. I won't ask you to swipe your credit card on your radio or anything. We actually do that for free, which is kind of cool.
Do you think that there would actually be a breakup of Facebook? Because I think that would be more difficult than breaking up other companies that have been monopolies in the past.
Yeah, I remember. Of course, you were like 1 year old, but the breakup of AT&T, which, again, there are different circumstances. I mean, well, there was the internet back in the early 80s, but not in the form that it's in now. And there was no AT&T U-verse and email, other services they offered. They were just Ma Bell, the phone company. And I was right in the middle of it. My parents bought me AT&T stock when I was born, and I got like one share of each of the seven baby bells for the AT&T stock. And as we all know now, and Ron Feinman and I have talked about it, AT&T is now really a much bigger company than it was prior to the breakup. They unbroke up, whatever you want to say. They undivested because what was Ohio Bell, Indiana Bell, and then Ameritech, and then SBC Ameritech, now it's all AT&T. Remember that Singular spun off as a cell phone company, spun off of AT&T, then it went back into AT&T. So although the world is different, again, there was the internet back then, but not in the form it's in now. And AT&T is a bigger company. So did we learn something from that breakup, or is it not really comparing apples to apples? Facebook is a young company. Again, we have a CEO who's literally a couple years younger than you are, Scott. And they have bought WhatsApp and Instagram. So should they be forced to unmerge with those companies or split into different divisions? Is that something that's anti-American to make them do that, or is there really an antitrust violation? It's hard for me to say. Facebook is going to continue to get bigger and bigger, but many companies dig their own grave, like what happened with MySpace. When companies like Facebook and Twitter come to town, they don't keep up. We've seen that in the retail marketplace. I mean, I cried when I went to the Sears and Polaris Mall, and you saw them going out of business and they're closed, and that's a story we all grew up with, and not to mention the Sears here in Marion. Penny's hanging on by a thread. Kmart, the same company as Sears, their stores, although some of them exist, they're a shell of what they used to be. I don't know what to do, Scott. Do we allow our free enterprise system to kind of take its course, or do we need to step in and break up some companies or help other companies out? Remember the bailout of the car manufacturers and some other things that have happened. It's hard to say, but at this point, I don't think there's enough antitrust with Facebook to warrant a breakup, but there may be in the future. Ma Bell was different because it's a public utility. Everybody has a phone. Businesses have phones. Police and fire obviously need the phone company, but Facebook is optional. Some people swear they'll never use Facebook, even though almost everybody seems to do so. But it's not an essential utility like Ma Bell was or is, and that's probably the difference. Sorry for the long answer, but that kind of sums it up.
Something that is interesting to me, isn't the long-term problem with calling it a trust going to be that it's free?
Yes, and that's part of it. It's an optional service, free, supported by ads, which is what Mark Zuckerberg said when he testified in front of Congress and, you know, sitting on his booster chair. The congressman asked him, well, how does Facebook make money? Well, we sell ads, which is the same way that radio stations make money. In our case, we offer companies and organizations to be supporters, so it's not quite the same as Channel 4 in Columbus or another commercial media entity, but the idea ends up being about the same. People have to be paid, utilities have to be paid, equipment has to be bought, and by companies and organizations and generous donors getting their message out and being visible. That's how those funds are acquired. And many times, ironically, you make more money that way. I used to work for a membership organization in Columbus, and they didn't make their money by providing services, that was selling merchandise. They made money by selling memberships. And that's often a good business model because you'll always have members. You'll always have people using Facebook, and there will always be companies that want to get their word out, knowing how many people use Facebook and the diversity of its users. People of all ages and backgrounds and incomes and ethnicities use the service. We obviously use it a lot here at the station. So there are some parallels, Scott, and again, our times are different because so many things are done over the internet, not just through Ma Bell. And Ma Bell is not free. It is technically optional, but you kind of have to have a phone of some kind or some other way to communicate with the world.
Doesn't this all come back to money, though? As altruistic a society as we are, we say, well, money isn't everything. But when you get right down to it, more people get angry, they get upset, and the whole trust conversation to me is about money.
Well, in the United States, we're a capitalist country. And money is pretty much what makes not necessarily the world go around, but this country go around. And, of course, we have politicians who want to think a little differently. But bottom line is, where I come from, money talks. And the equivalent of money, again, services, barter. I do a lot of bartering in my business, but bartering has many advantages. But it's still based upon the exchange of funds and the exchange of legal tender of some kind.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was watching a program on Alex Trebek this morning. Now, there is one of the richest television personalities in the history of television, and one of the most well-known, especially with this whole thing going on with the guy continuing to win. Jeopardy's having better ratings right now than they've had in a long time, yet this is one of the worst times in Alex Trebek's life. He has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. All that money doesn't mean anything.
Correct. Money does not buy happiness, does it?
It doesn't.
Many people, you've seen surveys, Ron. Ron. Scott.
Uh-oh.
I talk to Ron more over the phone.
You do.
But talk to you face-to-face, so we'll call. Well, I'm sure you wouldn't mind being confused with somebody of his intelligence and his,
no, he's
his general presidentological greatness. Anyway, Scott, no, you've probably seen the surveys that say people who are working class, I mean, not to the point where food's taken off the table. They make a living. They don't have a lot of extras, but they're happy. They're in a better mental state than people that are rich. It's covered on TV shows. We've covered the Jeffersons. Remember how they struggled with their newfound wealth? Again, it's only a TV show, but in many ways, it did reflect society. They were kind of, was Louise happier when she lived next to the bunkers? And she eventually got used to it. And again, it's just a TV show. But I think it does reflect society in many ways. The immediacy factor, the fact that you have to go to work, have to provide for your family cares, that you do put in a hard day's work, that provides a lot of satisfaction that you can't get from a dollar.
Well, I think some of the most unhappy people are people, I'm not talking about rich people, but I'm talking about people who have some money, because I think they're going to be happy because they have it,
right,
and they can pay the bills, and they may be able to buy some extras on the side. But the truth of the matter is, the things that bring them happiness is not the money, and they're still lonely. They're still ostracized.
Money doesn't buy happiness. It may pay the bills. It may let you buy nice cars and nice clothes, a nice house, get gifts for people you care about. But when you go to bed at night, are you happy? I don't think it does. It depends on what people's priorities are. And you only live once.
Do you think people have better priorities now in the technological age, or did they have better priorities in the 80s, 70s, 60s?
I think, as we've talked about, you know, when I was a kid, kids, including myself, wanted a car. That's pretty much what you wanted when you were 16, 17 years old. Now people want the latest $1,000 iPhone or the PlayStation. They don't even seem to want a car anymore, which I can understand, but it just seems so odd. And, you know, you're kind of in that middle generation, Scott. I'm not sure, you know, 20 years ago when you were becoming legally an adult, if you'd rather kind of have a fancy phone, a fancy computer, because they were coming into being at that time, or you kind of wanted a car, like seems like a lot of teenagers. And you watch the TV shows, you know, and I watched the 70s and 80s TV shows. What did Greg Brady want? A nice car to show to his girlfriend to take to the drive-in movie. Now, drive-in movies kind of became déclassé when I was at that age, but you still wanted a nice car, even just to go to the mall or go out to eat. Or just and show your friends, or just go cruising around town. And now it's like, well, guess a car is nice, but kind of want the latest and greatest $1,000 iPhone.
I don't know. To me, monetary things have never really had a great. It doesn't do much for me, because I think that at the end of your life, death does not discriminate, disease does not discriminate. And you better have a good time rather than a bazillion dollars in the bank. Because if you develop Alzheimer's, if you develop dementia, if you develop stage 4 cancer, all those $1 million in the bank aren't going to do anything for you.
We're all buried 6 feet in the ground.
So you better have had a good time.
Yeah. And there certainly are things you can get with money, but there's no price tag on happiness or a fulfilling relationship if you're pursuing that.
Do you think people are as... I don't want to use the term fighter, but I guess that's maybe what I'll say for lack of a better term. When it comes to wanting what they want, to me, people seem so subdued now. If somebody tells them something, they say, well, you can't do that. Okay, can't do it. Nobody says, well, how am I going to do this? What can I do?
Seems like you can go on your smartphone and be in a fantasy world.
Yeah, but I don't.
That's part of it.
I mean, people just seem to accept the worst. And now, if somebody comes with bad news, they just say, "Well, okay. What can I do?"
Yeah, I guess with all the smartphones, people are kind of in a fantasy world, and I think some of the political candidates are in a fantasy world. Maybe that's why they're popular.
Well, I just think any successful person, when you look in their background, people told them no. You can't do that. You can't. No, that's not going to work. But they did not let that stop them. They said, okay, that didn't work, so what can I do?
Yeah, remember Albert Einstein. He failed math a few times, didn't he? Told he would never be a success. Dr. Feynman and I talked about political candidates, and again, some of them have never lost, including Donald Trump. But of course, it's his first attempt at elected political office. Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, they lost. Reagan, I would say the most popular president in my lifetime, he lost. But he came back. I'm sure he was glad that he did.
Well, this is the thing. I'm not sure if people do that now. I really do wonder what people's motives are in life. Because do they have more friends? Do they have a better life? Are they happier? I don't know. I don't think they are.
My best answer, Scott, is just that you can do almost anything on your computer or smartphone, and we're in this virtual reality. People don't stand on their porch and have lemonade with the neighbors anymore. They just play games and tag people on Facebook. Not just young people. 70, 80-year-old people do that also.
But are they just as happy?
I don't think so. The milk of human kindness can't be replaced. The human interaction. You can't get that. You can't get that from a machine.
And is there any way to fix it?
I'm not really sure. When Facebook is so big, people are considering that it should be split up. That means that Facebook and the idea of being in this virtual world has overtaken us. At this point, probably not. Otherwise, again, Facebook wouldn't be what it is, and they wouldn't be talking about a divestiture like with the phone company. And as you said, the phone company being a paid service and a public utility, Facebook being free and something which is optional. So again, there's an apples to oranges comparison.
Well, it's interesting to me because when I think just about driving, because we're heading into Memorial Day and July 4th and Labor Day here over the next few months, who would have ever thought that the number one thing causing accidents would not be drunk driving anymore? It would be texting while driving. Something you do totally sober, totally in your right mind, but you still make the choice to do it.
It's very addicting. Is it more addicting than drinking or smoking? It is, because you have to buy alcohol. You have to buy cigarettes, and it's not exactly cheap either. Texting is free. Again, you have to have the equipment, but the equipment's not that expensive. I mean, you can go to Walmart and get a prepaid phone for less than a carton of cigarettes. So which is more addicting?
Couldn't they have done something, though, with all the technology that when your car starts, your phone won't work?
Well, they have apps to do that, but it can be defeated. And it's many people do it because it's a good idea. The best way is just self-discipline. But that's like with anything. You know, I like to eat, and I try to eat healthy. And you see, I look healthy. So I think I eat healthy and understand, yes, I can indulge a little bit, but maybe do it on a fruit salad and not on a chocolate cake or something that's going to be fattening and not have any nutritional value. And willpower is important in many things. And of course, we have kids doing it. It's very dangerous when a 16-year-old who's been driving for a month does it. And that's why many parents have their rules. But you know, as I talk to my clients, when I was a kid, my parents made rules, curfew. For example, no drinking or smoking, and no going somewhere alone, especially after a certain time. Now it's like, well, we should have computer rules. What websites can you not visit? When will you lose computer privileges? Will you lose computer privileges if you don't get at least a B on the test, or if you cut class? Those kind of things have changed, and obviously it extends to potentially deadly situations like using technology when driving. And that applies to people of all ages. I'm not just saying that it is slanted toward young people. 70, 80-year-old people do it also.
Well, it is true. I would not lay it all on young people. I think all ages of people are doing it. But I just wonder, what did people used to do when they were in the car? I mean, you couldn't get a message.
They used to listen to the radio. You know, interestingly, Scott, is it because a lot of current music isn't as good as older music, at least in my opinion? I don't think that's part of it, because we have many radio options. I mean, talk stations like us, and of course satellites. So if anything, radio has gotten better. So I don't put any blame on that whatsoever. They concentrated on driving. Now, you might say, well, why are there maybe less accidents? Well, cars have gotten safer. There's been many, many advances in technology which have made cars safer, including some semi-automated features where it might brake or steer away if there's an impending accident. But we're seeing those statistics, I think, increase. And we may find, yeah, that the most dangerous thing behind the wheel is not having a six-pack. It is texting and driving, and that's really scary because of the ease of doing it. You have to buy the six-pack. Obviously, alcohol, it's fattening. In addition, something you have to buy, and you have to sit down and actually do it. With the texting and driving, you get one text from your girlfriend saying, hi, honey, I miss you, and you're sitting there driving on a curvy road at 50 miles an hour, and you start typing away in an emotionally charged conversation. You can imagine that's a recipe for danger.
See, but why would you even answer it? That's my question. Before you even know what it says.
People are addicted. Why do they light up a cigarette when their doctor told them to quit?
I don't know, but
it's more addicting to me because, again, you have to buy cigarettes. You have to take the action of lighting it up and smoking it, and you have to go buy the six-pack. For example, now with all the casinos, people are getting addicted to gambling, even though they were before with the lottery, but all the casinos we have, we're obviously seeing more gambling addiction. And you can voluntarily tell the casinos, don't let me in. And you show them your ID when you walk in the door, and they say you're on the not allowed list. So there are some barriers in place, but texting and driving is so easy. What do? You get a text. And maybe it could be an important text. Maybe you're looking for a job and your new boss says, hi, Joe, you're hired. Can you start tomorrow? What do you do? The safe thing is you pull over. I mean, and not on the side of the road because that could be dangerous. Pull over to the speedway, go buy yourself a cup of coffee because you deserve it, and text back saying, hi, Mr. Jones. Sorry, I was driving. I don't want to do anything dangerous. Thank you for hiring me. I'll see you tomorrow. But no, people don't do that.
But you know, this all comes down to temperament with me. You know, people may eat the right foods and people might exercise and people might do the best they can. But one of the things I've noticed is that people will go 0 to 60 in a minute on a temper. And that's interesting to me because when we had Dr. Art Yulian on a few weeks ago, his contention was, and you hear it all the time, the number one killer is not bad food. The number one killer is not non-exercise. The number one killer is stress.
Correct. And the idea that you have to reply to this text because it's important. Oh, if I don't reply to my girlfriend, she'll think that I'm sleeping around on her and she'll break up with me. So I better say, hi, how are you doing? Even if I'm driving down the road or if it's a new job, your new boss will understand that the example I just gave you and will commend you for being safe. That's the kind of person you want. But people don't do that. The ability just to reply right away. Now, again, there are some intermediate steps which arguably are safer. For example, the speech to text. But if you use that while you're driving, do it carefully and preferably at a traffic light. Yes, it is safer, but there is still an element of danger.
I just don't know. I think temperament in general is a bad thing because I look at people, not just politicians, I look at people in general, and it seems like they try to make things more difficult on other people, not easier. You know, I saw a conversation the other day with a person and the guy who was mowing their grass. And the guy who was mowing the grass had taken the money, had every intention to mow the grass, but just had not mown the grass yet because it was too rainy. And the person was just screaming, I've already paid you the money, I've already done it. Why not just say, okay, come back when the grass is dry, period. Now, maybe he wanted it mowed that day. Okay, that's fine. I understand what you want. But why create more trouble than is necessary? Why not remember the 50 times that this guy did mow your grass and did a good job?
I think we have a society, Scott, based upon immediate gratification, which is kind of the way the texting and driving is. You don't remember used to go find a payphone and call your answering machine and then type a code in, and then you call the person back when you get home. Well, now you just text them back, Facebook them back, or give them a call, hopefully not while you're driving. So we want things immediate. My phone's in my pocket. I'm available 24 hours a day. And we didn't have anybody in that situation 20, 30 years ago when, yes, even with an answering machine, you can check it, but you'll probably wait till you get home before you call them. Right now, people are available immediately. And with almost everybody having a cell phone or Facebook Messenger, a way to reach him or her directly and quickly, you don't remember how you used to call and ask, you know, is Bill there? No one does that anymore because it's always Bill's phone, which is, I think it's kind of interesting. And I see that when I talk to my customers, because normally we, and unless there is a landline and normally it's a cell phone, we go ahead and have the cell phone of that particular person. If you notice that, Scott, you call somebody, you know, yeah, and you don't. And even people in a business often have a company phone that you call them on. You don't call a family. You know, again, look at the TV shows of the 70s where you go the Brady Bunch. Mike answers, Brady residents, or Alice answers, and it's any of six different people. And now it's a case where, you know, even the kids 12 and up, they have phones. So it's like you just call them or text them directly.
Whole different world. I tell you what, we've got a break here. We're coming back with another hour, and then Adam will be live again today, as he was last Thursday from 2:10 to 3 p.m. We've also got Voice of the People with Linda Sims, 4:10 to 5, and The Pastor Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker, 5:10 to 6 p.m. Lots of live programming right around the corner. Don't go anywhere.
Have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors.